Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's edition, we sit down for a rollicking visit with Christian LeBlanc, who you may know as Michael Baldwin on the long-running CBS soap opera The Young and the Restless. He'll even share which classic Louisiana cookbook helps him keep authentic home cooking on his Hollywood dinner table. Then, Joe Brock of NOLA Green Roots teaches us how to keep chickens in the city. And world-renowned food scientist Harold McGee makes sure we know how to properly cook the eggs from those chickens. It's springtime on Louisiana Eats. You may know Christian LeBlanc as Michael Baldwin on the popular long-running CBS soap opera The Young and the Restless. But New Orleanians recognize Christian as a true blue Jesuit Blue Jay and a Tulane grad as well. Consequently, despite his many years in Hollywood, at heart, Christian is still a hometown boy. Christian, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
You said that only because you saw me finish off lunch.
Well.
That's right. The stomach of a goat, like a true New Orleans boy.
Only, yeah, like we can only eat the innards here. So please explain this jump from pre-med into theater and TV.
That we talked a little about. Yeah, this is all a failed attempt to pay for medical school. There was a colleague of mine at Tulane who had doing all these acting and modeling jobs, paying for his first year. And I knew it would be expensive and I needed to figure something out. And a photographer, Cal Yee, took a picture of me because we used to work out at the pool with me and all my friends who were now in medical school. And that started it on its way. And my first job a few months later was a PBS series called Edit Point, done in Jackson, Mississippi. And it was the biggest project they'd had. And afterward, the co-star was like, do you want to come to New York? I'm like, yeah, sure, fine. Find a department. Like, that was easy to do in the 80s.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's just,
You never looked back?
Well, you know what I did? You know, I will tell you this. In the middle of As the World Turns, I realized that I loved what I did. And I couldn't go back.
Well, while we're talking about circling back, I imagine that by now some of our regular listeners must be wondering if they're listening to Louisiana Eats.
because, we're hungry. Does that count?
Well, you know, in fact, after all those years in Hollywood, Louisiana Eats is still a big part of your life. Isn't
Huge
it?
Part. You can't take that out of a boy who's born here.
And you're not quite a cook, all. Aren't you?
I'm a good cook. I'm a good Cajun cook. You know what my first cookbook was? La Bouche Creole.
Really?
Yeah. I think my mother put it in my suitcase when I left New Orleans.
Did you ever meet Leon Sonia?
No, not at all.
He was a treasure.
But the stories in that book were so evocative of New Orleans that it references a great deal of my aesthetic because I was not, you know, I traveled so much. I was an army brat. And so New Orleans came to me late and I learned about New Orleans history when I was away from New Orleans. And like everything, I think when you're away from it, you value it more because you miss it. And I was just telling you, I've just been home in New Orleans for Mardi Gras and did one of the things where we had the family and the big pot of everything on the stove and whoever knocked on the door loaded with beads came in and ate. And I'm blissed out. Just amazing.
So have you converted a lot of cast and crew members to our way of eating?
They did not need converting. We are so famous. New Orleans has such a brand in this country. I've never heard, the first response to 99.9% of the people when I tell them where I'm from is I want to go there, or I've been there and it's wonderful, or it's someplace I've always wanted to go. And the next word is food.
Mm-hmm. Yum. Well, another really interesting thing to me about the folks that you're working with is that one of your fellow cast members is a trained chef.
Yes, Jessica Collins, Cordon Bleu. And she is just wonderful. And she's brand new to the show. And she's stunningly beautiful on top of that. And she loves food. But yeah, so she loves it. And she has the only working kitchen on the show. She has a column and a website and
A blog.
And she's just one of these great foodies. And there are a couple of people on the show. Jeff Branson earned his living while as a chef. So
I'll be bringing
some big guns down to New Orleans to try us out. But they love it.
I had no idea that you could be a chef. I'd love to know. How do you make that jump from cordon bleu chef to soap opera star?
I tell you, it's the nimbleness of being an actor, in which you always look around for something to keep you flush while you're pursuing your career. So I think Jessica pursued her passions. She loves food. She loves cooking. I think when I hear her talk, I hear you talk, and the great chefs I've met in my time, it is one of the high arts, and it was always considered that. A fine chef is somebody close to God. And it's an amazing gift to have. And we have that in spades down in New Orleans. And I think she just respects that. And to watch you, I have to tell you, Poppy, we just came from lunch. So we're high as kites as far as food goes. And to hear somebody talk about food who knows it and is passionate about it is just a wonder.
Well, just like any true Louisiana lover, you have been responsible for making many of your fellow cast members great fans of our state. How did you engineer that exactly?
Honestly, it's pretty effortless. When you say I'm going to New Orleans, it's not like I have to twist anybody's arms. And I've had people from Days of Our Life, from all different shows that have come down with me. And God bless, they will come up and go into the swamps with me to raise money.
Shaking cans in Thibodeau, right?
Going into the Walmart, and wherever three or more are gathered in our name, we will take money from you. And just taking that Highway 1 to cut off and just raising what we can. New Orleans kind of soaks up a lot of the charity work here. It's such a, you know, and well-deserved and well-needed. But there's so much need out in the parishes, the rural parishes in particular, that those are my people. You know, I'm a LeBlanc. All those LeBlancs that owe you money, those are my people.
You have taken this whole art another step further, because you must be just an incredibly persuasive man. Because I know that you have somehow managed to sweet talk them into actually shooting here on location.
Again, this city's doing them a service. We are the number one market. New Orleans, Southern Louisiana, is a huge market for the young and the restless. So it behooved them. Again, their argument sometimes is we're preaching to the choir. But you have to know that they put that into my storyline, because one of our executive producers along the line has a house in the Bywater and was a huge fan of the city too. And I tell you, once you've tasted what New Orleans is, it stays with you, especially if you are an artist of any type, because it is one of those cities that just seems to pull that creativity out of you. So yeah, they came down here, and I won't tell you I wasn't up in that office telling them exactly where they should shoot and the beautiful places that we have to offer. And I got to say, they didn't need to be sold by me. I mean, it just made such sense, and the city helped, and the city was part of this. But, you know, New Orleans' biggest selling point is New Orleans and
That's
its people.
True.
And we got the best interviews, because you're being interviewed as somebody who's coming back to New Orleans, but you're from New Orleans, and they're asking you to interpret your people to them. Like, it was an interesting thing about why would this be the number one market? And I really had to think to myself, it's because we live these soap operas.
Yeah.
We are about extended families. We all know who your mama is. We know where you went to high school.
Yeah.
And we all know what that means.
Exactly.
She is a trashy girl, that one.
Now, you are so generous with your time, and you are so good about lending your star power to various charities, and I know a lot of them are local. Tell us about some of the local charity work that you've done.
I do a lot of an organization called the Mad Hatters, which is a national. Everybody shows up at these things, and it's up the bayou in Thibodeau. One, they named after my late mother, the Alice LeBlanc scholarship, a nursing scholarship. So I do a lot for them. But we've done different specifics from different people that I've known in my life. My old junior high principal was raising money for a safe house up in the river parishes for abused women. I do a lot for St. Jude. I have actually kidnapped people off of planes and made them get out of Memphis when we've been doing cross-country trips to go see St. Jude, just to see the good work they do. There's so much to do.
Well, you know, I have to admit that me and my ulterior motives, I have captured you, and you've agreed to be my new co-chair.
Evil genius Poppy Tooker.
No AIDS Task Force, Dine Out for Life. We're
going to
set the world on fire with that this year.
People, this is an amazing charity. How many restaurants signed up last year?
Over 100. But there are over 1,000 restaurants in New Orleans, so watch out. We're coming for you.
Don't button your pockets or close your wallet because you might as well just not do it.
Dine Out for Life this year is July 18th, so we have some marketing time between now and then. Well, I just have to say, Christian, I want to thank you for making one of my personal dreams come true. Please come back.
You invite me and I am here. It would be my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Christian LeBlanc, also known as Michael Baldwin on The Young and the Restless. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero was just a kid of 18 when he arrived in New Orleans in January of 1961. The young up-and-coming drummer had traveled to the birthplace of jazz to hone his craft with the jazz greats who were living and playing music here at the time, all of whom were black men.
So I came to New Orleans. It was great, but the big thing that most people don't know anything about anymore because it's sort of so long ago, segregation.
Much to his surprise, he discovered a racial climate very different from his home in Great Britain.
All my friends and the people I came to hear, I'd heard most of them on records, you see. That was the good part. The bad part was, when we got through this, what we're doing, we said, well, let's go get a beer. Let's go get a cup of coffee. You couldn't do that, see? The white people, well, they had the upper hand. You know, it was as straight and simple as that, you know. And not all of them relished that idea. Not all of them subscribed to it. But most people seemed to because they were brought up with it.
When our hero had to join a union, more trouble arose.
Yeah, another phone call I had that same night was a guy said, this is the Klan. He said, you better get out that such and such local by sunup or we're going to raise your voice a couple of octaves. Well, you can see I still can sing bass, you know. I said, you've got to come up the stairs and watch. There's no light there. I said, you be careful when you come up there because you like to fall on the stairs. I said, but I'll be waiting for you with a shotgun across my lap. And I said, I'll be up there all night waiting for you. I said, I'd love to talk with you about this. It was single file. They'd have had to come one by one, and I could pick them off like turkey shoot.
That's why jazz drummer Barry Martin is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations, Barry, and thanks for helping break down another color barrier from the time of segregation. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. When we come back from a short break, we'll discuss the chicken and the egg. Joe Brock introduces us to the happy girls of his urban chicken coop. Then, world-renowned food scientist Harold McGee gives advice for perfect egg cookery. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Do you love pomegranates like I do? The fruit, native to Persia, has been grown in the Americas since 1769. Pomegranates are more popular today than ever, not just because of the beautiful accent they provide in salads, but because we also now know that they are the most powerful antioxidant of all fruits, with potent anti-cancer and immune-supporting effects. They were always one of my favorite grade school lunchtime treats, but my exuberant enjoyment usually resulted in inevitable telltale blood-red stains on that snowy white uniform blouse, something that displeased both the nuns and my mother. In a recent posting on one of my favorite internet sites, Food52, I learned a foolproof way to extract pomegranate seeds from their leathery skin without any mess whatsoever. Just cut off the crowned end of the pomegranate and quarter it by cutting slits into the skin, just not deep enough to pierce the fruit. Then plunge the pomegranate into a bowl of water and pull it apart. Magically, the white membrane that contains the individual compartments of seeds will float to the top, and the seeds will sink to the bottom. Drain and dry with paper towel, and you'll have bowls of perfect pomegranate seeds for cooking or just for snacking. There's even a how-to video on the Food52 website. I'd love to hear what you're learning on the internet these days. What are your favorite food sites? Email us at louisianaeats@wwno.org and let me know what's cooking on your computer. I'm Poppy Tooker. And you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Joe Brock, in many ways, is your typical urban chicken farmer, because chicken is not his day job. By day, he's an accomplished web designer, but in late afternoon and early morning, Joe hears the call of the coop. We're visiting the Wise Words Community Garden, one of the sites he helps maintain as executive director of NOLA Green Roots. Standing here in the shade of the I-10 on-ramp at Tulane Avenue, the little green oasis where Joe's chickens live is part of what was once Crystal Preserves. Joe, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having me.
So what have you got going on here?
Well, we have chickens, lots and lots of chickens. It's wonderful to watch them grow from little bitty chicks to now medium size. So they're like 3 months old. As time goes, it's almost like similar to raising any animal. You're going to have to constantly study for symptoms, for different signs that you want to be aware of. So you want to stay on top of that.
Would you introduce me to your girls? I'd love to know what varieties you've got here. And do you talk to them? Do you call them?
Presently, we have Leghorns. We got Rhode Island Reds here, as well as Americanas. And those are different varieties, but they're a group that can actually work together with each other. All of them come with their different personalities. Rhode Island Reds are very somewhat territorial about their areas, but they can all exist when you have the right amount of space available. Now, if you look at them carefully, I'm going to share a secret with you, and this is something that chicken lovers know. These are little baby chicks, but they look almost grown. However, you can tell by the top of their crown whether or not who's more developed to start laying eggs than others. And as that begins to slowly define, you'll notice that they're ready to lay eggs.
A question I know a lot of people have is that for chickens to lay eggs, do you need to have a rooster?
That's funny, because that's actually the number one question we constantly get when people visit us. They don't necessarily need to have a male to make eggs. They make them, but they're not ovulated eggs. When you decide to get a chicken, you want to know why you want it. And there's several reasons. One can be to make eggs to eat. Another one could be making eggs to make more chickens. So you have to decide which purpose you want that chicken for. Also, you have to feed them accordingly to that purpose.
I know that chicken keeping takes a lot more time and effort than adopting a puppy, for instance. So how can people learn about how to do this?
A good way to do that is by taking a Nola Green workshop class on chicken. We hold them every third Thursday of the month, and they can sign up early, come out, and actually see chickens. Also ask as many questions as they need to ask about the laws, about how to take care of them, as well as those up and down questions that they may have that may not fit every particular person.
I read on your website that Nola Green Roots will actually come out and help people build chicken coops. How does that work?
Well, what we do is we ask that they call us up, and we have someone in the office who will actually take their information down, come out to their site, measure off the area they want that coop to exist. We can build it on site, or we can build it somewhere else and then bring it to them. So we have a group of people who are trained to actually build those coops and then bring it out to them.
So what are the laws about keeping chickens in the city?
Well, that's a good one. That's another question that people constantly ask about. Our laws in New Orleans are mostly superseded by Louisiana law, because when there's no really concrete laws on the book for New Orleans, then what trumps that is Louisiana law. So we follow Louisiana law on the purpose of how we keep chickens and how we monitor chickens and how we take care of them. Presently, chickens can be bought in by folks who are going to take care of them. I recommend anyone who's going to get a chicken to first consider taking a workshop or taking a class on chicken first, and actually asking the right questions about what a chicken will do at a certain age, what will they do as a group, can you keep one chicken, what is the recommendation. So those are important questions.
Do chickens get lonely if you have one chicken?
Just like any animal, they may get lonely. When horses are at our racetrack, they're recommended to have a goat nearby or having a dog nearby, because just like people like companionship, so do animals.
So the girls know you, huh, Joe?
Yes, they do. I call them in the morning. I have a little saying that I say. I'm a little embarrassed with saying it.
Beetle. Come here, Beetle. Beetle. Beetle.
They're actually waiting on something, and I need to go get it. They love earthworms and stuff like that, and that's one way you can actually train them. And I'm telling you a little bit about my secrets at the workshop, but those are different ways in which they'll get into habits. Even with feeding them, if you just the same typical 1, 2, 3 steps, they'll get used to knowing that. They know sounds, they know different techniques, and they can pick up those things as a routine. And they like to work in groups. That's another thing about chickens. Chickens are similar to what you watch in nature with deers, how deers all run in a pack. And they the weaker ones will follow the stronger ones because they know it's safer to follow that. That's the same way these chickens operate.
Is it dinner time for the girls?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I'm about to go feed them now.
Can we stay for dinner?
As long as you don't think of any other ideas.
Okay, that's a deal.
Because my girls are watching.
Joe Brock, Executive Director of Nola Green Roots and Chicken Keeper Extraordinaire.
I'm a chicken plucker. Plucking is a lot of fun. Give me 6 or 7, I pluck them one by one. I'm a chicken plucker. Plucking on the daylight shift. Plucking comes natural, I guess I got the gift.
A visit with New York Times curious cook, food scientist Harold McGee, is like taking a food chemistry course in what makes a recipe a success or a terrible failure. We visited with Harold recently at the Hotel Monteleone for an exploration of the not-so-simple egg. Something as simple as an egg is really one of the most challenging foods, I think. And I'd like to know, what do you think the biggest mistakes that home cooks tend to make with an egg?
Well, I guess I would say it's not paying close enough attention to the temperature. So it turns out that any protein food like eggs, meats, fish, all of those things where texture is so important and they can dry out so easily or get tough so easily. The key to getting the right texture is temperature. The proteins denature at a very particular temperature and they begin to dry out above that temperature. And that temperature is right around 140 degrees Fahrenheit. So anytime you go higher than that, whether it's an egg white or a steak or a piece of fish, you're going to end up with something that's denser and rubberier and tougher and all the things that we don't want. So just paying attention to temperature, I think, can go a long way to helping out.
What do you perceive as some of the most almost magical things that you can see done with an egg?
Well, in a way, it's the range of things that you can do with an egg. The egg has the white and it has the yolk, and you can combine them or you can separate them and take the whites by themselves and take that volume of white, say two or three egg whites, and you can, just by adding air to it, turn it into a solid foam many times that volume. So it's like eating air. And you can raise soufflés and meringues and all kinds of things with that. Or you can take the yolk, which is dense and rich and succulent and full of delicious fat, and make an ice cream that's really rich and kind of melts in your mouth in a way that no Philadelphia-style egg yolk-free ice cream can.
Let's talk about mayonnaise for a minute, too, because I've always heard that mayonnaise spoils very quickly and is a very deadly proposition once it goes bad. And I've been very, you know, respectful of mayonnaise my whole life. And yet, I know a lot of people who keep their commercially prepared mayonnaise in the pantry instead of the refrigerator, and I haven't seen any of them die from it. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. There are several different things going on there. The first thing is that commercially made mayonnaises are made in ways that you wouldn't make mayonnaise at home. So they're made with pasteurized egg yolks. Some of them don't even have egg yolks. They have other things to give that thickness. And they're prepared under very strict hygiene. And they often have preservatives of various kinds in them. So even with all that, I wouldn't keep it in the pantry. You know, it's fertile territory for bacteria and molds and things like that to grow. But it's got a much better chance of staying edible than something you make at home where you're using probably a raw egg yolk and then you're not adding preservatives. Although it's true that lemon juice and vinegar are very good antimicrobials, and so there's a kind of built-in defense against spoilage in mayonnaise. So I think it's certainly not the terrible source of food poisoning that people think it is, but it's also not something to just leave out forever.
Let me see if you recall this conversation. One of my dear friends, Darren Nesbitt, said that at the time that he was, I believe, at Commander's Palace, you helped him tremendously with a hollandaise problem, and God knows they make vats and vats of it. So I was thinking that you probably might get phone calls or emails from people who say, help!
That one in particular it's a really interesting example because there is a classical way for making hollandaise where you take the egg yolks and heat them very gently on their own with some vinegar just until they begin to thicken, and then you add the clarified butter drop by drop in order to make the sauce. Turns out, if you think about the chemistry of hollandaise and exactly what's happening, you can do the following. You can take all the ingredients, the eggs, the butter, the vinegar, or the lemon juice, cold, put them into a cold saucepan, turn the heat on, start stirring, and in 5 minutes, the sauce makes itself. And it's a wonderful thing. It's, you know, one of those things where you just feel as though nature is on your side for a change. If the butter is in chunks, and you haven't gone to all the trouble of clarifying it and so on, and you start to heat it that way in the egg yolks, while the egg yolks are getting warm enough to begin to thicken, the butter is very slowly melting and releasing itself gradually into the eggs at just about the same rate that the eggs are thickening. And so you've got these two different processes which classically you take control of and you do them separately and that has all kinds of problems, or you can let the ingredients kind of take care of themselves. And it's a relief to every professional chef I've told that.
That is an incredible story. Thank you so much for sharing that, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Food scientist and curious cook, Harold McGee. After the next break, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Kathleen Merrigan discusses the Food Hub, a food distribution method proving to be vital for Louisiana's small farmers. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Classically trained chef Ryan Hughes is an inspired artist with raw ingredients. Here to inspire us all with some new tastes for your plate is my friend, Chef Ryan Hughes.
Hey, Poppy, how are you today?
Oh, I'm so happy to be here with you. So what about anchovies, Ryan?
Oh, boy, anchovies. Gosh, when people hear about anchovies, they turn up their nose and they think of the bony, salty, briny things that somebody would put on their pizza and you'd have to pick off.
Invariably, that's the reaction you get.
Correct. I get the same thing when I'm making some of my red sauces and my compound butters. I know we've done a recipe before with it, and people ask me, well, why do you put anchovy in? And look at other cultures where they put soy sauce into something, you know, so it gives it, I think you used the term one time when we were talking, like a body salt.
That's what my cooking teacher, Madeline Kamen, taught me.
Right.
So often people, that because they're afraid of the anchovies, they think that it's going to taste fishy.
Never.
But there isn't a fishy taste at all.
It shouldn't, unless you use too much, you know, if you go to town on it. No, it's just a little bit. It's just like a kind of a background flavor and taste. Doesn't taste fishy. Eastern cuisines have been using it for thousands of years with their fish sauces, you know?
I think a great secret weapon is having that tube of anchovy paste.
Absolutely.
In your refrigerator.
Indispensable. If I put maybe 12 things that I had, you know, as a staple that doesn't really go bad that much, that would definitely be one of them, because you can take that and just do so many different things with it. I think we've done something with shard together on it. A good thing about using anchovy then as a rule of thumb is you need balance with it.
Mm-hmm.
And for your listeners, what that means is acidity usually. So you need something to balance out that body salt kind of background flavor. So acidity kind of cuts it and neutralizes it at the same time. So you see the majority of recipes that use anchovy, they almost all have some type of acidity in there. And so that's key.
Now, of course, when we're talking anchovies, 9 times out of 10, we're talking about the tinned anchovies.
Correct.
Particularly great tinned products from Portugal, I find.
The Portuguese ones, yeah.
But, you know, nowadays, you also see on restaurant menus beautiful white anchovies.
Yep.
And anchovies in other forms. Could you
explain,
explain the difference in that?
Okay, well, that's a great topic. When I was at Café des Gars, my sous chef, Laurent, he loved anchovies, fresh anchovies. And Laurent, he's like, I wonder if we can get fresh anchovies. I'm like, well, to be honest with you, I've never even eaten a fresh anchovy before. Never even had one. I was interested. So sure enough, I called up my fishmonger and I told him, I was like, what's the chances of us getting fresh anchovies? And he's like, well, now that you mention it, it was the season for it. And so I'm like, okay, I'm like, get me 4 pounds of fresh anchovies. First of all, they came whole. You know, you had to scale them.
Yeah.
These are the little tiny things, like, you know, elongated goldfish. And I gave them to my prep cook. And I'm like, okay, we need these by lunch. And this was 9 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, okay, you know, you just got to gut them and scale them. And he looked at me and he's like, do not ever bring these things in here again. I was like, what do you mean? It took him 4 hours just to clean 2 pounds of anchovies, you know.
And how'd you cook them?
I fried them.
Of course.
Marinated them in citrus. I think I put satsumas in it, Meyer lemons, olive oil, garlic, fresh herbs. Let them marinate for just a couple hours. You didn't want to permeate it too much and actually cook it. And then I used corn flour, dusted in corn flour, salt and pepper, paprika, and just quick flash fried them. And it was funny because I think the first day, nobody really ordered it except for the cooks. And Jacques, the owner, the guy's like, oh my gosh, you got fresh anchovies. Are you kidding me? This is great. And so we didn't sell them the first night, but then it was funny because Café de Gare was such a great place. A lot of the Francophiles and a lot of the French and Europeans would gather there. And I think it was like the Anchovy Underground found out about us. And sure enough, the next day there was four or five people there that heard that we had fresh anchovies. And I used them the rest of the season. We put them on the menu every single weekend.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for this fantastic lesson in anchovies.
Oh, Poppy, anytime. Thank you so much for having me.
My favorite culinary consultant, Chef Ryan Hughes. The Department of Agriculture has focused increasingly on food hubs as a way to more efficiently distribute food grown by small farmers. U.S. Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Kathleen Merrigan toured Louisiana this past spring investigating the current state of our food hubs and possibilities for future development. We caught up with Kathleen at Hollygrove Market, which she cited as being a successful example of a food hub at work. Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan, I'm so honored to have this opportunity to talk with you. And I know your specific trip to Louisiana this time was focusing on food hubs. Would you explain what a food hub is?
Certainly. It is a point where local farmers, small, medium-sized farmers, bring their produce together. It could be fruits, vegetables, meat, what have you, food. And then the food hub puts it together in quantities that are large enough to attract institutional buyers. Institutional buyers that don't have the time or the resources to contract with all these little guys. And they're looking for a consistency and a quantity of product that a small guy can't deliver. So these food hubs are central warehouses. They have loading docks where trucks can go up and such. And they usually have professional help with marketing and distribution so that the farmer doesn't have to take that on top of growing.
Can you give me any concrete examples of what might be happening currently in Louisiana or what you see coming on the horizon?
Well, here we are at Hollygrove, and it's such an exciting place. You've got dozens and dozens of local urban farmers producing food, creating jobs, and they are selling here direct to chefs. Chefs who want more and more of this local produce because their customers are raving about it. And so we need to do this upscale across the country, not just Louisiana, but across the country. And right now we have about 223 food hubs that we've identified, but I think that's just the beginning. We need to do much more. And why I am here in Louisiana, which is such a great food state, in New Orleans, such a great food town, I'm here to announce the release of a food hub report where we document successful case studies of where food hubs are working. So we make the case for them, and we also are showcasing how USDA, Department of Agriculture programs, can help facilitate this for people out there who are trying to figure out how to make it all work.
So did you find any new developments during your trip here that you found surprising?
Well, I actually met with a bunch of Vietnamese growers who are undertaking aquaponics in their home situations. They're using their yards in very creative ways. This is still part of the post-Katrina recovery effort, people trying to reinvent themselves. And knowing that there's this huge wave of consumer interest in locally grown and eating healthy, I walked a family's urban farm on their property where they're producing unbelievably yummy-looking greens and basil, all kinds of luscious food, and they have the fish in the tanks, and they're using the nutrients from that water, the fish waste, to water the plants. It's very, very safe. It's very, very delicious, and they're selling to local restaurants. So I thought that was innovative, exciting, and a real evidence of the kind of resilience in a community coming back from a terrible devastation.
How do you believe that the food hubs will further develop in the future?
Oh, I think they're going to go great guns. And if we have anything to do about it at USDA, we're going to make sure that happens. I see a lot of communities who are interested in it. We have a website totally devoted to food hubs. We also have a website called the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food Initiative. People can go there right from our front page, usda.gov, and hit the Know Your Farmer icon. And there's a geospatial mapping tool that shows people about all the local investments that USDA has made to help with the local food movement. You can use it to see what's going on in your community. You can enter your zip code and say, I want to see everything in 50 miles, 100 miles, 400 miles. You might be an organic grower and you say, I want to see everything around organic. Or you might be interested in developing a commercial kitchen. You put in kitchen. There are a lot of different ways of sorting this map. But maybe most importantly, it's a great springboard of ideas. So you can go and say, well, this is what's going on in Louisiana, but I'm going to go see what they're doing in Iowa or Massachusetts or California, and I'm just going to go and cherry pick across those ideas and see what I can do in my own community.
One of the phrases you just used really catches my attention because I have been involved in the farm to the table, the school to farm and farm to school programs since Alice Waters and I have been at this together for I think you know how many years. And when I hear you say, know your farmer, know your food, it's almost like I'm having a surreal moment because that phrase itself has always been sort of a catchphrase of what has largely until now been sort of really an underground food movement. How has this become mainstream?
Well, consumer demand. I mean, let me tell you, I'll be frank. I'm the Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, but innovations don't happen inside the Beltway. They happen outside in the country. And so what we've seen is people are demanding locally grown. It is creating jobs in rural America and in urban America, too, as we see in New Orleans. So we're really excited about it. And the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative was something the secretary asked me to lead. We've been going around the country saying not every family needs a lawyer. Apologies to my husband, who is one. Not every family needs an accountant, but every family needs a farmer. And then I like to add this tagline on, do you know yours? 99% of us have no connection to agriculture. We haven't been on the farm or the ranch. 1% of people produce our food, and we need to, as a country, as a society, to reconnect.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and really thank you for this great inspirational work you're doing. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I'm telling you, I had the blackened drum last night. I had some grits this morning for breakfast. This girl from Massachusetts is having a good old time here.
Well, come back and see us again soon. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
That was Kathleen Merrigan, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, reporting on food hubs, a promising new distribution method for small farmers. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Jay is a food blogger for the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, as well as a frequent contributor to Louisiana Kitchen and Culture magazine. His weekly blog covering the food scene in northwestern Louisiana can be found every Tuesday on 20by49.com. Chris is also our North Louisiana Eats roving reporter. So, Chris, welcome to Louisiana Eats, and tell me, what's happening in your neck of the woods?
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me, Poppy. I've just been really appreciating lately a little grill called George's Grill, located on King's Highway, opened in 1960 by a man named George Kasten. When he was 18 years old, he immigrated from Greece. He was hired as the busboy, and by age 25, he owned the restaurant.
Oh, he's living the American dream.
He is, and there's something about the place that really embodies the American dream. When you walk in, the pie counter greets you. I've never been anywhere where I felt so allowed to kind of linger and spend time. They will offer to refill your cup of coffee every time you take a sip. And the window that customers look out is this huge bay window that looks out on King's Highway.
Uh-huh.
So you're looking at this college campus. You're seeing the kids go back and forth. They're finishing the last bite of pie to rush to take a final. It's really romantic. It's really beautiful. And the whole place is bathed in this golden light.
So what sort of food are we going to find there?
Well, you're going to find everything from wonderful omelets to cheeseburgers, deluxe style presentation, but they're so basic. You know, I love the fact that it hasn't changed since 1960. You know, I talked to George's daughter, Teeny, and she said, these are the cheeseburgers that have been being served since 1960. Same meat company, which is a local meat company, Magnolia Meats. Same everything. Same pickles. Same mustard. I just love that sameness. You know, no matter what changes in my life, I know that I can go to George's. Cup of coffee, cheeseburger, those things will never change on me.
And so what else do you go there to eat?
Well, I also love the gyros. I mean, George is a Greek, and he's brought some of his favorite foods onto the menu, too. Pie is spectacular there. Down the street, you can get pie from Strawn's that's been in Southern Living six times, for example, you know. But no one talks about George's pie, but I love it. The meringue is four times as thick as the filling. It's just this incredibly delicious coconut cream, chocolate, wonderful stuff.
So what are the hours like over there?
Well, they close a little bit earlier because their crowd is older. You know, we tried to go the other night at 8 p.m. and they were closed. But they open very early, as you can imagine.
Yes.
So that the veterans and the musicians and the students can gather and get warmed up for the day. They open about 6 a.m.
So it's basically breakfast, lunch, an early supper.
Exactly, exactly. And it's just a really great place to kind of see a cross-section of America.
It must be very affordable as well.
Absolutely. I love that the cheeseburger, which is my favorite thing on the menu, I hate to keep talking about the cheeseburger, but it's about $3.25.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and it's caramelized a little bit on the griddle, and it's just so old school America. You know?
Do they do any sort of a plate lunch or what else?
There are daily specials. So you can get catfish, you can get oysters, fried oysters that are quite good, actually. But I always find myself returning to the omelets in the morning and the cheeseburgers if it's past noon.
Well, that sounds like a really, really great time. I'm going to have to meet you for a burger in Shreveport soon.
Well, thank you so much for letting me tell folks about George's Grill.
Thank you, Chris. Chris J., our Louisiana Eats roving reporter from Northwest Louisiana. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we take the trip from the farm to the glass with cocktail genius Adam Seeger.
I think when you go to a restaurant, one of the reasons you're going is because there's an expertise or there's specific fresh ingredients that are not easy to get at home. I think that's what makes it really special. So what we're looking at are having things that may have an ingredient that is unfamiliar, but introduce it with a little bit more familiar cocktail base and give people something really special that is on par with what the food is here and certainly the amazing wine cellar.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's.
Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Leitzegan and Westside Leitzegan Funeral Homes, LCI Workers' Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.